Okay, thank you. This is the Campus Governance Oral History Project, and I'm speaking to Joanne Elder about her involvement with governance as it evolved, developed and evolved. And I'm going to start out by asking about your education or your work experience prior to joining UW-Madison.
I grew up in Dayton, Ohio. My mother worked for the National Cash Register Company and, by the way, was a union steward there. I graduated from Oberlin College, where I met my husband, Joe Elder, and right after graduation, we sailed for India for 2 years teaching English in the schools there, which was a fellowship from Oberlin College. During that time, our daughter Shanti was born, and at the same time, Joe and I both did research for our master's thesis so that when we returned to Oberlin College, we could both complete master's work there. That was part of the fellowship. My husband went on to Harvard, and in Cambridge, our second child, a son, was born. We returned to India for Joe's doctoral research, and we lived in tents in a village for 2 years with our two children. Joe completed his degree at Harvard. Our third child was born that year, and Joe joined the faculty teaching sociology at Oberlin for 2 years. I taught a sociology course to nurses in nearby Elyria, Ohio, that year. We came to Madison in 1967, where Joe had a joint appointment in sociology and South Asian studies. The university was growing, nearly doubling in population over the next 10 years. I was asked to be a grader in sociology. I taught the introductory sociology course in extension several semesters, and one summer I lectured for the sociology department doing the intro to sociology course. Then I received a call from West High asking if I'd teach intro soc in West High. I demurred that I'd had no high school teaching credentials. However, that fall, Joe was a visiting professor at Wesleyan Scholars Institute in Connecticut, so I picked up a few education courses. Then I received a letter from the chair of the sociology department in Wisconsin asking if I would take a half-time position as undergraduate advisor when we returned. I accepted and then went on to finish a teaching certificate for education here, which I never used. At the end of my first year of advising, I was asked if I would like to be paid for the full time that I was putting in, as theoretically was a half-time position. I said I would, and I went on to be the undergraduate advisor in sociology for the next 30 years.
Good, thank you. I would like to talk a little bit about your role, let's do this first. We talked, and we've been talking, that a lot of the things that the academic staff are talking about now as far as collective bargaining and things are things that you were talking about 30-some years ago, and maybe part of the reason campus governance was created. Could you sort of tell me how and why you got involved with the movement back then? Some of the points that you can point out to us?
For one thing, my work in sociology put me in contact with many different parts of the campus. As an academic advisor, I worked with people in student personnel, in the dean's office, in placement, everywhere I went, I discovered these very talented, many of them highly educated, some with a PhD, that would have complaints about not having an input into governance, not having a way to lobby for their own salary increases, people who felt undervalued in the work that they were doing. Interestingly enough, some of the same people who would complain were also Well, they had no job security, of course, and so the academic staff felt that they needed to be concerned about not losing their job and therefore not being too noisily disgruntled about what they were doing. At the same time, I was saying, what we need to do is have a voice in governance and affect what we do. As I said, I did not have a fear of unions, but I have found that so-called professional people often feel that unions are beneath them. They feel that unions are for tradespeople. There is definitely a class feeling about unions. So while people would complain and say, yes, we ought to get organized, they didn't want to go so far as to join a union. I think it's important for us to take a look at how the academic staff developed on campus. Way back in 1848, when the University of Wisconsin began, the president and the faculty did all the jobs related to higher education. By the 1890s, in the interest of lessening the burdens of faculty, a non-faculty person became the registrar and secretary of the faculty. I'm sure that the faculty who left these positions, their teaching positions, and took on the positions of registrar and secretary of the faculty, had a sincere appreciation for the demands of those positions. I trust that faculty who were, people think of faculty as full-time teachers and so forth, but universities are very complex organizations. And consequently, I wrote a little article in the paper way back in 1976 trying to describe to the public what academic staff on the Madison campus was all about. Technically, the words academic staff mean professional and administrative personnel other than faculty and classified staff. In 1976, there were about 3,100 persons and faculty numbered, there were 3,100 academic staff and 2,200 faculty. This large group of persons has almost, of the academic staff, had almost no input into university decision making and, of course, very little control over its own destiny. So some of us decided that it would be a good thing to form a Madison Academic Staff Association. It was a wonderful group of dedicated, interested, and interesting set of people that came together. And should we stop here?
Sure. Gone.
As the university grew in numbers and in complexity, many roles were separated into full-time responsibilities other than teaching. As the research function developed, we had full-time scientists doing research and not teaching, clinical faculty in the health sciences, communicative disorders, social work, and education, to name a few areas, who did very little classroom teaching. We had full-time counselors and advisors, full-time computer experts, and the teaching areas in the sciences had full-time lecturers specializing in the introductory courses or some aspect of their discipline. And this was especially true in mathematics and the language departments. Now, there are many functions vital to the university, not to mention such specialists as editors, architects, archivists, librarians, and directors of special programs like the Arboretum. Some of these roles were filled by what we now call tenure-track faculty, but most of them were filled by professionals now called academic staff. Before 1974, it didn't seem to matter. A number of persons in student personnel work, directors of housing, memorial union directors, and others central to a given program were given faculty status in order to integrate them fully into university governance. But in 1974, a statute merging all public higher education institutions in Wisconsin made a clear separation between legal faculty and academic staff. At one stroke, this campus, which had people in all these roles working together as colleagues, suddenly had many professionals who were not tenure-track faculty and may have been here for many years, discovered that they had one-year contracts called fixed-term appointments. Faculty status was not given to new persons hired in student services. Indeed, persons with faculty status dwindled to about a dozen. The trouble really started before 1974 with the indiscriminate use of the title specialist, which could include a nationally known expert in tissue culture, a librarian, or a washer of test tubes, which did not involve professional work. Specialist became a least common denominator and lowered the status of all holders of that title. We were joking at the time that the hat check girl at the union was a specialist, as was a senior scientist in McArdle, a specialist. The millions of dollars of grant money, that is soft money, brought into the university, mostly by faculty, but also by some academic staff scientists, meant that many persons were hired for special projects related to the grants and were less involved in the overall academic life of the university. Many of these academic staff were here only a couple of years. Many have continued on soft money for over 20 years. Currently, we have academic staff with the highest degrees in their fields, and with national reputations, central to university programs, but they find themselves second-class citizens because they don't have the designated term faculty. So no matter how distinguished the person was on the academic staff, they didn't have job security, and they had no way to interact with governance at the university. And so at this time, the Madison Academic Staff Association took up some of these particular concerns and developed a newsletter and communicated with the whole campus, one of the few organizations to do this. By the way, we used tons of paper at the time because, as you know, computers almost didn't exist way back then, and certainly email wasn't available. Okay. So we wrote lots of newsletters and distributed them throughout campus at our own expense, and we charged $5 to join MASA. I don't know how we managed to survive.
Not by printing your own
newsletters. But we did. And I suspect that individuals contributed more than their share. So how did MASA begin? Well, probably because there were some like-minded people who identified these issues and came together to talk about them and decided to form a Madison Academic Staff Association back in 1976. We spent an enormous amount of time drawing up articles of bylaws and rules and regulations for ourselves, how to communicate with the entire campus, how to get standing committees going. We had a membership committee, a liaison committee, communications committee, and of course we had a nominating committee and a specialist committee and a steering committee and more committees than I can think of at the moment. But our point was to communicate with the entire academic staff and give them a voice. Give them a voice before it was mandated by the system that academic staff should have a voice. But then there was a lot of resistance to that, and more and more people were feeling pinched by either not having a voice or not getting raises or not having job security and having no way to protect themselves, that we did attract a fairly large membership at one time. And it was not, there was also a separatist group called the Specialist Organizing Committee, who just dealt with specialists as they defined them, and most of these were younger people, slightly more radical than the, quote, seasoned older people, and probably much more representative of the scientists. But I don't have the exact dates of when the Specialist Organizing Committee organized or dissolved, but there was some overlap.
There was, okay.
Between MASA and the Specialist Organizing Committee.
Do you want to talk about the how the makeup of the elections, the first group that some of them were appointed and others were elected?
We really should talk about how that came to be.
Okay.
The ASAC report, all academic staff should be aware of the importance of their representatives on the Academic Staff Advisory Committee. This was a university committee. And this is where the Madison Academic Staff Association, or MASA, played a major role, because we were organized and we had an all-campus organization at that time, so we did put representatives up for the election, and our MASA newsletter was one of the few all-campus newsletters that the university had going. I'm sure there must have been all campus news, and I should stop and probably find out what those were. The United Faculty, which was AFT, a regular union, existed at that time. The Wisconsin University Union was formed much later, was also a non-national union, and was not and was much less expensive than the AFT dues, but WU, as it's come to be known, the Wisconsin University Union, was working hand in hand with other groups on campus, and especially MASA, in trying to communicate the need for all campus organization.
Good.
I mentioned that in this very diverse campus of ours, we had specialists as editors, architects, archivists, librarians, and so forth. And some of these roles were filled by what we now call tenure track faculty. Others were filled by professionals called academic staff. In 1974, the statute merging all public higher education institutions in Wisconsin made a clear separation between legal faculty and academic staff. At one stroke, this campus, which had had people in all of these roles working together as colleagues, and suddenly had many professionals who were not tenure track faculty but may have been here many years, discovered they had one-year contracts called fixed-term appointments. Faculty status was not given to new persons hired in student services or anyplace else. Faculty status was phased out. Now, the trouble really started before 1974 with the indiscriminate use of this title specialist. I mentioned that. Now, many of these academic staff had already only been here for a couple of years, but many on soft money had been here for over 20 years. We have academic staff with the highest degrees in their fields, with national reputations, central to university programs, who found themselves second-class citizens because they were not designated faculty. The fundamental point is this. We had and have hundreds of very talented, well-credentialed, extraordinarily hardworking members of our academic staff who made enormous contributions to the university, the state, and the world, but who were not being adequately rewarded for their efforts. And they are asking why. Could it be because there's no role in Chapter 36, the merger legislation for academic staff? There is a role for faculty and students spelled out, but none for academic staff. The current advisory and non-representative role of the Academic Staff Committee inhibits its effective contribution. The Academic Staff Advisory Committee was set up in May of 1975 as an interim committee to develop procedures for setting up an Academic Staff Committee that would develop UW-Madison policies and procedures for academic staff and advise the administration on matters affecting academic staff. That committee included 7 academic staff elected from 6 areas and 4 academic staff appointed by the chancellor. Well, Massa's did a lot to elect the 6 academic staff elected. We put out a newspaper and a blurb about each person that was running. We were not happy that the administration did not trust the academic staff to elect a balanced committee, as they called it, and they felt they needed to appoint people who would protect the administrative part of the university. Always there is this tension between organization and the possibility of unions, and certainly the administration had a very negative view of unions and what unions might do. And therefore, they were being very careful that to make it as difficult as possible to prevent any kind of unionization of the staff. Actually, at that time, a union on campus would not have been allowed by the state. But actually, even after it was legislated, there was a lot of resistance, of course, by the administration. Massa always had to remind people that it was not a union, but an organization. And the Madison Academic Staff Association was made up of people who had the same tensions within the organization, those who felt that an organization was necessary to express one's views, and a very small minority who said, if you're really going to get organized, you should form a union. On the other hand, there is something, what, middle class about resisting a union, and it seems like in the university world there was a great resistance to having anything that resembled a union. But we did feel we should have representation that we could choose for ourselves in the Academic Staff Committee. And it took several years before the Academic Staff Committee became an all-elected committee. I'm not sure what year that happened. We can look that up.
We can look that up.
We will. Okay.
So the Madison Academic Staff Association, over the years, defined problems that academic staff had, gave a voice to academic staff, in terms of airing those problems and communicating to campus faculty and administration the need to interact with the larger staff and represent and give that staff a representative voice in the campus organization. Eventually, we had an academic staff assembly. And today, of course, there's an academic staff public representation organization that has as its job to keep track of legislation that affects academic staff here on campus. If we can backtrack a little, in 1983, the Regents did a thorough review of the 7,000 academic staff in the system. They found that academic staff lacked job security, opportunities for promotion, professional development, and a role in governance. Surprise, surprise. The Regents asked each campus to respond to these problems and report back in the spring of 85. And from that, of course, the academic staff, the governor appointed a committee to study salaries of academic staff, salaries, but academic staff was not included in that study. That was the first occasion when a differentiation was made between faculty and academic staff in budgetary policy. The Bornstein Committee, I think that was 1983, on academic staff salaries came later. No, must have come about 85. It did a good job of documenting how low academic staff salaries are at Madison as compared to their salaries at peer group campuses. Of course, this is supposedly the flagship campus, so that was very interesting. Now, that was the easy part, to document that. The hard part was to educate legislators and citizens on the important role of this highly trained academic staff on the Madison campus. And we wondered if the Madison faculty would speak up for the academic staff. Would profs lobby for the Bornstein Committee's recommendations on salaries, which would increase academic staff salaries? Or would members of the academic staff have to speak for themselves by calling legislators and educating them about the roles of academic staff in higher education? MASA, the Madison Academic Staff Association, jumped in to facilitate the efforts of individuals on campus to make a more collective voice heard. And at the same time, United Faculty and Academic Staff, AFT 223, took on that and role also and played an active role for both faculty and academic staff in the salary and budget process. Let's review some of the very early newsletters in MASA. In 1976, the MASA News talked about what is the most important election for you in 1976. I don't remember who was running for president that year, but
I believe it was Carter.
But the election of seven candidates to the 11-member Academic Staff Advisory Committee will be concluded this month. And so MASA put out a newsletter with candidates in all the districts, and we talked about what is MASA at the time. And the Madison Academic Staff Association is registered with the Secretary of the Faculty as an organization whose purpose is to stimulate an exchange of information among the academic staff on issues affecting their professional status and conditions of employment. Why should you join? Why does academic staff need its own voice? Now, the advisory committee's effectiveness will come from demonstrated interest of the academic staff, but it will be difficult for so large and diverse a group as ours to focus on an issue and reach consensus. the structure of a professional association is necessary to provide a forum for collecting, discussing, and disseminating ideas. And MASA wanted to be that forum. Where do our interests differ from the administration? The administration and faculty's concern is flexibility. That is, when necessary, how can cuts in personnel be made with a minimum amount of disturbance to the institution? It's in the nature of things that there be conflict between the desire of the administration for flexibility and the desire of the professional staff for some stability. Do other university groups see a need for their own voice? Yes, the Faculty Senate, the University Committee, many informal contacts provide a network of communication between faculty and administration. The students and classified staff also have a formal and informal channel. But the academic staff, this was back in 1976, because they were scattered and in many occupations, locations, and levels, had no formal channel and very few informal contacts with university governance. So MASA said, we will be that independent organization of the academic staff, and we will work for its interests specifically to promote professional recognition and advancement, encourage some kind of job security, and make sure due process is available when people are terminated, and lobby for a fair share of the budget resources for academic staff. Why do we exist? Why does MASA exist? To provide a structure for the academic staff to discuss and focus on issues of importance to them, and to make the views of academic staff known to faculty and administration. And then, of course, we facilitated the election by sending our newsletter around and asking everybody who ran for office to delineate their reasons for running for the Academic Staff Committee. We had many meetings, and we talked about personnel rules. We talked about representing all areas of campus, and we talked about the difficulty in uniting such a diverse group of people. We, of course, made our meetings public, and it was a mixed blessing. It did enable academic staff members to observe and occasionally participate as invited speakers. Presentations by academic staff members clearly had an influence on the thought behind the drafting of policy, which occupied the committee during the months of August and September. This was the Academic Staff Committee. Has MASA accomplished anything? And this was way back in September of 1976. MASA representatives spoke at the Regents hearing on UW system academic staff rules and helped achieve some major changes in the original draft. For example, MASA pushed for an all-elected committee to advise the chancellor. The original draft would have permitted an all-appointed committee. The final language read, at least a majority shall be elected. And of course, finally, we have an all-elected committee, but that's not the way it started. It was going to be an all-appointed committee. MASA gathered 500 signatures on a petition to convince the regents to include language to protect fixed-term employees who have served for a long period of time. That protective clause can be found in UWS 1003. The policies and procedures of each institution shall specifically treat the issue of protection in the case of non-reappointment for those fixed-term academic staff who have served the institution for a substantial period of time. That was a big step forward then. MASA publicized major issues prior to the advisory committee, presented the questions to all the candidates, set up a forum, and of course, 6 of the 7 elected members of ASAC were active MASA members. MASA members continued to be frequent observers at ASAC meetings and and participated in the presentation and discussion of concept of non-renewal and terminal fixed-term appointments. I'm looking over some of the back issues of the Massa News. We sponsored events such as strategies for facilitating grievance and fact-finding procedures through Massa, and what kind of affirmative action would Massa promote. We talked about personnel guidelines that would be some changes in the personnel guidelines to accommodate suggestions from the deans and directors. One of these changes viewed with concern by Massa is the section dealing with long-term fixed-term employees termination. This status, long-term fixed-term, will very probably apply to more of us than the indefinite status. And that, of course, turned out to be very true. A limited number of people received an indefinite status over the years.
Is that still in existence, indefinite status?
Indefinite status?
Yes. I've never heard that term.
You've never heard that term?
Mm-mm.
Well, that was what was used for a more permanent status, at least back in 1977. This was the term that was used. Okay. No more consideration will be given persons with 20 years of fixed-term appointments than those with 2 years of fixed-term appointments, except that persons with 6 years or more will be given referral priority, and whenever possible, 9 months instead of 6 months non-renewal notice. So these were early considerations. We talked about, in a memo to deans and directors on the 18th of January, 1977, we were talking about career-related training and coursework for UW-Madison employees. Oh, let's erase that.
Right. Joanne, I'm going to jump in with a question here. How effectively has academic staff governance responded to issues that matter to you and all academic staff? You were very involved with the early years of academic staff governance.
I think it was very important that the Madison Academic Staff Association spelled out the issues. A lot of people were feeling disgruntled, but didn't know how to articulate their feelings, and even more important, did not see any way to address the issue. So the Madison Academic Staff Association was able to educate staff as these issues developed, put out newsletters, defining the pros and cons of some of the personnel policies that were being discussed and voted on by the Academic Staff Committee. I think probably had a lot of influence on an educated voting population is important to a national election politically. An educated staff was important to what happened at the committee level on campus. And, you know, people in a university have jobs to do. Their primary focus is on the work that they're doing. They want to be excellent lecturers. They want to be tip-top scientists. They want to be the best librarians that librarians can produce. In student personnel work, their first effort should be to advance the quality of student life on campus. So we all had our professional work that we cared a lot about. At the same time, we realized that unless we spoke with a single voice, our rewards, our monetary rewards, our job security rewards, would be completely overlooked unless we were vocal about how important these things were to us. And so we needed to be organized. And this is true the world over. You can have a single voice crying out in the wilderness, or you can have the voice of many saying, this means a lot to all of us. And I think that's the role that MASA played and made a difference.
And MASA, as we know, is still in existence, still doing the good work that you all laid out. Now, you have alluded to this. In the early days, was participation in academic staff governance was well-regarded and supported? Or did that sort of come as a gradual sort of?
It definitely was gradual.
Okay.
I think as the administration worked with the combined elected and appointed academic staff, I think they had more respect for those that were elected. And of course, we know that eventually all of the academic staff committee became elected. Do you know what year that was? I could look that up.
I think you thought maybe it was 85, or was that too late?
Maybe approximately then.
Maybe mid-80s, yeah. So it started, I mean, obviously in the mid-70s, that was not the case. And so you sort of won your right to
to speak
on your own.
Yeah, right.
By the 80s, mid-80s.
In one of the, in 1977, we had to spell out the difference between MASA and the Academic Staff Committee. So one of the October issue spoke to that. Early drafts of Chapter 9 to 13 called for an Academic Staff Committee to advise the Chancellor, and thanks to MASA, the final draft of the System Personnel Guidelines called for an All Academic Staff Committee. We also conducted a questionnaire in that year, in 77-78, asking a whole lot of questions of the entire academic staff, and I think that was helpful mm-hmm. to the administration. Such questions as, do you approve of the concept of the Academic Staff Review Committee and their makeup? Most comments spoke out for a 1 year's notice for job dismissal. Several said that professionals on the academic staff should have at least the same consideration as untenured faculty.
Was this survey something that you all felt was important?
We did.
Okay, and it wasn't something that you were asked to do. It was
No, the Madison Academic Staff Association felt that this survey was important.
Okay.
So I think it was helpful to both the staff and to the administration. To see what people out there were thinking. Many of those who commented on the differences between non-renewal and terminating for cause felt that this distinction was too vague, it could be manipulated by the administrator. There was concern for capricious charges of insufficient productivity, creative effort, or failure to communicate effectively, which are difficult to prove. Mm-hmm. So it gave everybody a voice to comment on what was going on.
Seems pretty comprehensive.
We commented on fringe benefits and spelled out the fringe benefits to which academic staff should be entitled. We talked about health insurance, which I think is still mm-hmm. very much a topic of conversation today. We said that all academic staff should have their own copy of the publication, Fringe Benefits for Faculty and Academic Staff, which they didn't have at the time. They could ask for it, but they had to ask for it. It certainly wasn't distributed. We did a questionnaire about collective bargaining and had arguments for and against. And generally people, the staff in general, was not in favor of collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. As I said, I think there is status involved in that. Mm-hmm. We put out, in May of 78, we had a very clever, I thought, Massa News, where we pointed out that a six-person university committee, a 232-person faculty senate, and 2,400 faculty versus had a 232-person faculty senate, whereas the academic staff, made up of 11 persons, were representing 3,000 academic staff. And it's a little harder to represent 3,000 people with an 11-person committee.
Very true.
We had articles about indefinite appointments and the problems therein. We had an article about faculty status, who had it, who didn't, and why it was being phased out, more or less. We had an article we invited the Vice Chancellor, Mary Ann Yodelis Smith, to speak to Massa. She talked about affirmative action and equal opportunity programs. She is responsible for applying state, federal, and university personnel policies, and she would also help administer sabbaticals, instructional improvement, and in-service training, which would apply to all academic staff. We had an article about academic staff and faculty salaries and doing a comparison therein, and several articles about academic staff salaries. Which made people at least aware of what went into planning for salary increases and what the obstacles were for increasing academic staff salaries, mm-hmm. What the obstacles were for increasing job security for academic staff, and trying to work out programs that would alleviate some of the these problems. We talked about one of my favorite Massa News things was called the invisible academic staff, and we made a comparison. Most people don't know that there used to be a cupola on top of Bascom Hall, and we said we are as invisible of that as that cupola, which used to be on the top of Bascom Hall. Mm-hmm. UW-Madison has changed over the years, and so have we. Academic staff are now as large as the faculty, much larger than the faculty, and like the dome on Bascom Hall, and we had a photograph of that, frequently forgotten. So the academic staff newsletter was there to remind people that the academic staff existed in great numbers and was doing wonderful things for the university. But we had to blow our own horn.
It sounds, and you did quite a lot to help with
actually I think maybe that was one of the major roles for the Madison Academic Staff Association, was to blow the horn of academic staff,
mm-hmm.
and show what a wonderful group of people it was, mm-hmm. what great things they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
We also took it upon ourselves to communicate with our state senators. Senator Fred Risser made an hour appointment with one of our group at one point, and I think he stayed for 3 hours, became quite an advocate for academic staff. As you know, Fred Risser is still mm-hmm. doing good things in the Faculty Senate. We arranged major meetings with the administration. In 1981, President O'Neill spoke to the Academic Staff Association, which was very well attended. So we were calling to the attention of top administrators at the university that there was an academic staff and that we were a large group and we were important.
And they were listening.
And that was the role of the Madison Academic Staff Association. So I think they did a lot of good things over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Its history will exist on the basis of its publications, I'm quite sure. I'm sure MASA is still publishing stuff, or is it?
We still do. We have a brochure, and we have a website.
Great.
Which a lot of what you have done on paper is on the web.
Is on the web.
And through email, we contact our membership and do a lot of the planning that you mentioned is still happening as far as brown bags and discussions of the issues and even some fun things, you know,
uh-huh.
socials and that sort of thing.
Yes, that's very important to
I
have some fun things.
It's fun, and we do breakfast for the staff early on in the year, usually around October, and it's amazing how many new faces we get each time. So I guess the word's coming, getting out. But there are a
Great.
Lot of academic staff that I think now, if I'm right, there's 7,000 academic staff on
really?
Campus.
Really? Yeah.
And we'd like every single one of them to join MASA, but we haven't gotten there yet. So.
Well, you're still plugging away for the importance
mm-hmm.
of a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the Madison Academic Staff Association has always been that voice. Very proud of having had a hand in the beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some people that it was fun to review this history. And I really intend to get an early history put together on paper
mm-hmm.
so that I think I've done a fairly inadequate job in this quick interview because I'm sitting here looking at a table full of all of our newsletters, all those old newsletters, all the committee meetings of 10, 20 years when I was active on campus, and I mean just on academic staff stuff active on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, we were on campus from 61, and of course, my husband has not retired even today, and I'm talking to you in
2009.
Mm-hmm. So we've come a long way,
mm-hmm.
a long way in terms of governance
mm-hmm.
and a voice. I think the academic staff has a respected voice on campus.
Do you... Joanne, I'm going to sort of change direction just a bit, not much, but what is your sense of the existing relationship between academic staff and faculty?
I'm guessing that it's a whole new world. I remember way back in the early 70s, as I said, my own work in sociology reached out across campus to deal with many different offices on campus. I certainly had a very supportive faculty in the sociology department. actually, I have been teased to say, well, you had job security because you had a husband who was a faculty in the same department. But let me tell you a couple of early things about that. Had I finished my doctorate, which I had intended to do, I could not have been hired in the sociology department because there was a no nepotism law at that time.
Okay.
So that, of course, was changed, I think, in the 70s, when it was demonstrated that the people who suffered most from the no nepotism rule were women. But at any rate, if I were giving advice to people today, I would say, oh, go ahead and finish that degree, because I always wished I had finished my degree, because it means a lot in an academic setting. I'm conceited enough to think that my master's was well on the way to a PhD degree, and I wouldn't have had a heck of a lot of work to finish it. But I never did. I never did, partly because of the fact that I couldn't have been employed on this campus because I was in the same field as my husband. Mm-hmm. But people said, "Yeah, well, you had job security because you had a husband in the department." Actually, that's the opposite is true. It seems to me that women who had husbands to support them, theoretically, in my day, in the early pre-women's lib movement, women were fired much more quickly because they had husbands to support them. So I don't think that having a husband in the department kept me in the department. I'd like to think that what I was doing supported me. But at any rate, I started to tell you the story about crossing the street in front of the social science building and ran into the then woman chair of the Faculty Senate. And we were talking about some campus issue. And I said something about, well, you know, I think that perhaps academic staff should be represented in governance. And she looked at me in horror. How could an upstart like me think that women or academic staff should be, I mean, obviously she was a woman, so that's why I mentioned that she was a woman and was heading up the Faculty Senate at that time. But at any rate, the look of horror on her face that I should even think such a thing was instructive, shall I say. So maybe she was the one that inspired me to start organizing MASA. Although, you know, I don't claim to be the organizer of MASA. We have to look back at those early chairs, Ross Reinhold, Karen Carlson, some of the early committee chairs were very important to the original organizing of the Madison Academic Staff Association. Alistair McCormick, Pat Miller, Bob Miller. Bob Miller was very active. He was in the School of Education. He was a dean there. Pat Miller was a scientist, I believe. Karen was in communicative disorders. We had a good broad representative group who were in the early founders of MASA. Dick West, who was a librarian in engineering. So MASA wasn't my baby. There were a lot of people out there getting ready to have a voice and knowing that the academic staff needed a voice.
Do you think the attitude of the chair of the Women's Studies or the faculty committee,
mm-hmm.
was that the general feeling?
Oh, I'm sure it was the general feeling. A university is for faculty and everybody else is just there. And so we really had to spend a lot of time in the MASA newsletters and in the work of the Madison Academic Staff Association to just delineate the importance of the various groups of academic staff and the contributions each of these groups made to university life. And that wasn't hard to do. The university couldn't run without its academic staff. So it was right and proper that we were out there tooting our own horns.
And as your work progressed, did you see then the change in the attitude towards academic staff, toward, well,
Yes, I think so.
You saw a change.
I think by tooting our own horn, we then illustrated the good work we were doing. And I think gradually I had more respect of faculty, and there in all cases there were faculty that were very supportive of academic staff. I certainly had faculty very supportive of my work, and I think this was a lot of scientists, senior scientists, had a lot of respect for the scientists, academic staff scientists who were working with them, and right down to the contributions of the support staff that worked with the support scientist. I mean, everybody had a role to play, and it was important that people were rewarded for the work that they did. Certainly, in the student personnel work, I think faculty had appreciation for the many tasks that student personnel people took off of faculty so that faculty had more time for teaching and research and didn't have to play the role of advising students, which was difficult for faculty to keep up with changes in university rules and regulations. That just speaks to the world that I was living in. And faculty were happy to be relieved of those kinds of responsibilities, but also could have some respect for what they meant to the student.
So the faculty were appreciative of the work you were doing. They may have initially been a little, what's the word I'm trying to use, as far as your coming together and working to communicate the issues of academic staff, but they didn't ever feel like there was a threat or anything.
I think the threat was academic staff should not be telling faculty what to do. And I think that was a delineation we had to make. Faculty Senate should be the Faculty Senate dealing with specifics to the faculty itself. But it was still important for the running of the university to have a representative group representing that huge other group of people at the university, all now delineated as academic staff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This.
So, you know, it was important that we didn't, while we asked for a role in governance, we asked for appropriate roles, roles in governance that affected us and our salary and our long-term role there at the university.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So fair employment practices, I think, were not. Now, scientists said, well, look, you know, we have a grant, and we can't hire people beyond the grant. So then we worked out personnel rules that could be accommodated by what? Grant overhead? I don't know how it works today, but there still should be some guidelines for people who have been here in any number of years, even though they've been on grants, that they aren't terminated, you know, without some long-range consideration.